fog is lifting. She's in a rowboat on a lake. She is dreaming. She is drifting. Never been so wide awake. Captured in the moment by the beauty all around her. There's nowhere else that she would rather be. And Virginia looks up. She says, this could be my day. And she thinks a thought of thanks for all the things that come her way. And some say she's a dreamer, and some call her a fool. But before you even blink your eyes, Virginia saves her mind. Grabs her backpack, hops a jet plane, heads to France, grows a garden, writes a screenplay, and she's learning how to dance. And all the possibilities of her imagination are turning into her reality. And Virginia looks up, she says, this could be my day. And she
Hello, you are listening to KDRT LP 95.7 FM, and this is Corinne Motokaitis, host of How She Really Does It, where inspiration and possibility meet. I believe there are many valuable lessons to be learned from other people's journeys, and my lifelong quest has been to use inspirational success stories to motivate and empower others to achieve their personal best. How She Really Does It dives into the depths of people's lives to help others realize their own personal potential and goals. This talk show is meant to inspire, empower, and entertain and be a resource. I'd love to hear listeners' comments about our shows or questions for upcoming guests. You can email me by going to my website, www.howshereallydoesit.com, to send me an email. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there and find links to both Twitter and Facebook on the website, as well as podcasts of our live shows. They're also available from iTunes. New York Times bestselling author Alice Schroeder returns with us today to talk about Warren Buffett's mindset and what we can learn from one of the wealthiest men in our country. Her book, The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life, and many of you have heard me talk about this book. It was my favorite in 2009, and newsletter subscribers know that. So Alice, hello and welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me on again.
It's great to have you on. So,
well, I'm very excited. This is one of my favorite interviews that I did last year. It was wonderful.
Oh, yay. Thank you so much. And this is coming from a New York Times bestselling author, you guys.
Well, I love your website, and I check in with it, and you have a lot of impressive guests on, so I am honored to be here.
Well, thank you. So, you know, the reason that your book so struck a chord with me I mean, and I'm a life coach, and I work with entrepreneurs and people about money and stuff. And it just seemed to be a lot of evidence for me about just the clean thinking that Warren Buffett has in his life. And I feel like that is one of the key components to his success in his career, in his lifetime.
That's absolutely true. You know, he is someone who, perhaps out of necessity and certainly partly by design, has taught himself in a very, very determined way to separate what he needs to focus on and what he's trying to achieve from all of the mental clutter that goes on. And in his life, there's a lot of things that would cause that mental clutter, and yet he's never let it stop him from what he wants to achieve. And I think there's a real lesson in that.
And, you know, well, and he didn't see a life coach, obviously, to go help him with that. But how was he able to, I mean, there's so many factors. Like, I can think of just being a child born of the Depression. He didn't buy into the story of being a child born into the Depression and that it wasn't possible. How was he able to do that?
You know, that is a great question, Corinne, because one of the things that I think was true of that time and is somewhat true now is that in those times, although life was very rough, and when I researched the book, I saw how difficult it was. I mean, it was a period when, talk about the schools not having money, the schools were falling apart, and the sheriff would go around and collect taxes from the parents, you know, in order to keep the schools open. It was really bad. And at a birthday party, you know, kids would show up with a package of underwear for, you know, that was a great gift because there wasn't enough money to buy it. And these were in upper middle class households. And Warren grew up in this atmosphere, and what happened was that people had the attitude, focus on the positive, the glass is half full. And while that's a cliche, they lived it. And what I see now, especially when I talk to younger people, is that that's coming back. And it's great to see it coming back because I saw him use that and work with that where he just separated in his mind and put away the bad. And it wasn't like it didn't exist, but he just put it in a box, and it went away, and he didn't work with it. He didn't let it affect how he behaved.
Yeah, you use the metaphor, it's like going down the bathtub drain.
That's right. He called it the bathtub memory, and that's when something bad would happen. It would go whoosh down the bathtub, and away it would go, and it would be as if it would never happen. And in his case, it was so extreme that he would actually forget it. And so you can talk to him about certain events, and he doesn't even recall them, although they were bad. Now, I'm not sure I would recommend that. But there are a lot of great psychological techniques that you can use that different people will promote in things like neuro-linguistic programming and all kinds of other methods that teach you how to retrain your thinking so that you don't let your mind ruminate. You know, on problems and focus on the negative, but rather let them be replaced by positive thoughts and feelings and to go forward into your goals. And that's what he sort of did through, I wouldn't call it self-therapy, but somehow for survival, he knew he had to do that and he did it.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. I mean, that's one of the things that I coach my clients on is like, we call it story fondling when they keep reliving, you know, these thoughts that may or may not be true. And they find evidence to support why it's not possible, right? There was plenty of evidence for him to find that it wasn't possible for him, a boy in Omaha, born out of the Depression, to become a millionaire. But he chose not to use that evidence. Instead, he used that book that he found when he was a child and said, hey, I can be a millionaire by the time I'm 35. And then he worked on the newspaper and it was like, oh, okay, I made this dime, but that this dime is the next 10 cents towards my path of becoming a millionaire instead of some people would say, but it's only a dime. It's not enough.
Mm-hmm. I see that. And what I think was so impressive about him is that he had a talent with money. And so he was able to ignore the circumstances of the Depression and use his own talent and say, I have confidence in myself. What was even more impressive to me is that he had zero social skills, no emotional intelligence, and in fact, if anything, the opposite. He was someone who was a complete social misfit. And even there, he decided, I will make a positive decision not to let this cripple my life. I will go out and acquire the skills I need to become socially successful, to become liked, to become someone who can have positive relationships with many, many people who will be my friends, and so that I will feel comfortable and I will have a large network of people that I can rely on, because I want to have people in my life that I enjoy and trust and who surround me and make me feel good, and I don't want to feel isolated and a loner and shunned, because that was how he did feel as a child. And this was a very conscious decision on his part, and he had no raw materials to work with whatsoever, so he went out and found them. And he read books, he took a Dale Carnegie training course, and then he lit on another strategy, a very smart one, which is he looked around him and said, who do I know that has good skills with people? And he befriended those people little by little and learned from them. And he studied what they did and mimicked it, mirrored what they did, and then worked his way up. And it took, you know, the important thing is he didn't expect it to work overnight. So he started when he was a kid, and he was still working on it when he was in his 30s and 40s, but it, you know, gradually you can see what it's accomplished. Is he's probably the best-liked businessman in the world. You know, that's an amazing thing.
It is an amazing thing. And I maybe that's part of the reason that I just so loved the book and just the thoroughness of it. But because, you know, prior to reading his book, I knew Warren Buffett was very successful in finances, obviously, and about his holding company. And but I never realized he represents so much of my show, right? It's about the possibilities. It's about the inspiration and the possibilities and seeing what's possible. It wasn't that he had the silver spoon that was handed to him. It wasn't, you know, like you said, there was a lot of stuff that he had to overcome to become who he is today. And
right.
And I think so often when we look at people, we go, oh, yeah, easy enough for them to do this because their life was so much easier. And it sounds like reading your book and talking to you that he worked really hard and he had to face a lot of his fears.
You know, what's funny is that he was a little uncomfortable with this aspect of the book, because he's used to the public thinking of him as this person that he is today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard for him to admit that he had to work so hard and that he had to create himself, you know, that he's self-made. Because, in effect, it's like letting in the chinks and letting people look at the weaknesses and judge him and criticize him and along the way how successful he was. Whereas if you just look at what he is today as if he had always been that successful, then you just don't even question it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he really, you know, we had these conversations and I would sort of explore, well, how did you learn this and how did you figure out that? And that was one of the most uncomfortable parts of the writing process for him, because it was very hard for him to acknowledge how hard he worked. And yet the more I pushed at it and explored it, the more I discovered that he worked his tail off.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that Warren Buffett worked his tail off, I think should inspire anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he did it, then, you know, it tells you that there's a lot of opportunity for anyone.
Well, and that's the thing that I think is so important with both you and I about his story, is that, yes, he's the second wealthiest man in the world, but we can take information from him. We can take nuggets from him to help us improve our own lives. Tell me where I'm wrong with that.
You're absolutely right. And when I was writing The Snowball, I was going through an experience myself with him where it was having a dramatic impact on me. And so I thought, you know, this has got to be more than a biography. I've got to give this as a gift to the reader. The reader's got to be able to go away and say, I read this book and I learned all of these things that would really help me. So I put into the book a lot of the things, as much as I could, of what I learned and was helping me. And some of the concepts that I put in, for example, were things that he learned, for example, about criticizing people, that Warren adopted a policy from Dale Carnegie when he was very young to never criticize anyone publicly, because if you do, they'll never forget it. They'll never forgive you, no matter what they say, if you embarrass someone publicly. And this sounds kind of like a truism, and it sounds sort of obvious and silly, but when you look at how people actually behave, and particularly on the internet and in emails and things, there is a lot of behavior that's subtly critical or subtly judgmental, and people, you know, experience repercussions of that, and it doesn't get forgotten. Then some of the other examples were how to value your time. I saw that he was very good at making people feel that they were important to him, while not giving them control of his time, not letting people simply use, you know, call him. I mean, he would say, call me whenever you want, but at the same time, he would keep the conversations very short as a way of easing people off the phone. You know, I know you're really busy, and then all of a sudden the conversation would be done, and you would think, wow, I got to talk to Warren Buffett, but you wouldn't really feel dismissed, and that's a real art form.
And how
all of these things, I just kept putting more and more into the book.
This is Corinne Motokaitis, and my guest today is Alice Schroeder. She's the New York Times bestselling author of The Snowball and The Business of Life. How was Warren Buffett able to get off the phone so gently? He would tell them that they were busy, then he knew they were busy?
He would tell people that he knew they were busy. But the other secret is he would be thinking ahead in the conversation. So when he would start the conversation, and he, by the way, this is what I figured out, not what he told me, because he would never say that he does this, but he would clearly have in mind how much time he had to spend. And so if someone called him, he would be thinking 15 minutes. And as about the 10-minute mark would approach, he would begin to steer the conversation in the direction in which he wanted it to close. So he would know that he had about 5 more minutes, and he would begin to head toward wrap-up type discussions where if the person called him for advice, he would begin to draw them towards making conclusions from what they were learning. He would begin to help them draw lessons out of what they were hearing, so that when the time came towards the 4-minute and 30-second point, he could say, well, that sounds like you've really learned a lot, and I'm sure you've got to go to your next phone call. And the person would feel satisfied that they've gotten what they wanted.
Wow.
So it was about thinking ahead.
That's incredible. Because I'm sure there's just so much time demands, so many people wanting time from him, and wanting to, he does like to have public approval, doesn't he?
He does like to have public approval, and this is another very interesting thing that I learned about how he manages that, is that he manages to say to people that he's very accessible, calming anytime, and yet, because he conveys through his demeanor that he values his time, other people don't abuse it.
Uh-huh.
So he's not seeking, through conversations with people, validation from them. And because he's not doing that, they don't try to take his time. And I that's a lesson I think is really, really helpful to learn, is that if you're in your conversations with people, if you're always seeking validation from people, then you'll have a very hard time setting boundaries with people in terms of how much they want from you, in terms of talking on the phone, asking for things, because in exchange for that validation, they're going to feel entitled to whatever in terms of using your time, asking for favors. And, you know, Warren actually is not as self-confident as he would appear, and if you read the book, you'll read all about that. But he trained himself, and again, this is learning discipline, he trained himself not to ask for validation in his behavior. And it turned into a way of enabling him to maintain more equal relationships and avoid problems in relationships. Very, very good way of interacting with people.
And so, how
people would validate him? They would say good things, but they would be legitimate. It wouldn't be out of neediness.
How did he train himself not to seek out validation?
Well, I think he's someone who's studied, and he's. For someone who's not taken a psychology course since, he's taken like one psychology course in his life, and it was, 70 years ago or 60 years ago. I think he's one of the most astute psychological observers of people. But I think anyone could do this because, anybody could listen to a show like this, read a psychology book, read a couple of self-help books, and get a little coaching, and you can learn to study some of the basics and the nuances of how to interact with people and maintain boundaries. And I think that's all he did, is he just learned a little bit about boundaries, and he learned a little bit about transactions with people. When you interact with people, what are they asking from you? What are you giving them? And, you know, one of his habits, I'll give you another little tip, is he always expects the other person to do something for him first. And that has been true through most of his life, but it became increasingly true as he got wealthier because he learned that people always approach them asking for something. And that in order to test whether they're sincere and truthful and whether they're just a user, he learned to make them do something for him first.
Wow.
So, which is, sounds kind of manipulative, and I, you know, it's not something I would apply across the board unilaterally in every relationship. But if someone comes to you and says, please do this for me, please do that for me, you know, I think you have to think, where are they coming from? And he quickly picked up with the radar, you know, how to figure out, you know, is this person selling me something, or are they offering me something, and is the relationship a two-way relationship, is it reciprocal, or is it a one-way relationship where in exchange for them making me feel good, I'm going to end up paying them, giving them business favors, introducing them to people. You know, so he learned to tell the difference between the tangible and the intangible, and I've seen this with a lot of people where in exchange for a person stroking their emotions, they end up giving away a lot of real stuff, you know, and learn not to let that happen to him.
You know, it's incredible because when the backstory of his childhood and stuff, because what I remember is his mom wasn't emotionally stable. Is that correct?
Oh, she was very sadistic, is a fair term, and the family had bipolar disorder running in it, and so it was very poignant story. His mother was not bipolar, but she had a really volatile personality, and his grandmother, great-grandmother died in mental hospitals, mm-hmm. and there's other family members affected.
And it's amazing because so often people would carry on that legacy that they had, right, to define them of who they were and say, well, of course I'm not going to be good with people, or of course this. But it's so interesting because with him, he just decided not to accept that part. And not let those circumstances define him as he moved forward in his life.
Mm-hmm. And what really intrigues me is that he never, and I think it's important to make this distinction, he never therapeutically addressed the fears and anxieties that he has.
Mm-hmm.
So this is somebody who still has residual emotions and problems with these things, and I wouldn't, I referred to his lack of self-confidence. I did not think that he's achieved his potential in terms of his growth, in terms of human potential, and yet despite that, in terms of making a satisfying life for himself, without getting that help, he sought other kinds of help to achieve goals that he set in terms of business, relationships, and others that were achievable for him because he did what he could, and I think it's great to know that you don't have to get it all right, you know. You don't have to, you can separate being able to, go and learn to climb a cliff or learn to play the piano. There's all these different goals, and just having something bad happen to you doesn't have to stop you for that, and you don't have to achieve enlightenment, you know, and become the Buddha in order to be able to do these things.
Interesting. Yeah, it's incredible because when you say that, you know, I'm sure the listeners out there thinking, well, she said that he didn't achieve even to his potential, but look at him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I think can be kind of dumbfounding for a lot of the listeners out there.
Right. And I think if you separate different kinds of achievement,
mm-hmm.
some people are on a spiritual quest to achieve self-actualization.
Mm-hmm.
Warren never really went on that journey. It wasn't even the journey he wanted to go on. Yet his journey that he went on was to make himself a more effective human being in the world,
mm-hmm.
to accomplish tangible goals in business, to make his life richer in dealing with people and having friendships and relationships. And those are all extremely worthy goals.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes people get very hung up on the inner,
mm-hmm.
and they feel that if they haven't accomplished their inner journey, then they can not be effective in these outer goals. But the two actually can be attacked separately, and he did that.
Well, and in your book, you talk about when he went to go speak at Georgia Tech, and this was when Susie was in the hospital recovering from her surgery, and one of the things he told the students, may I read this part?
Mm-hmm.
It said, the purpose of life is to be loved by as many people as possible among those you want to have love you. And that was a real big switch for him, wasn't it? Because up until that point, it was more for him about making money and being powerful, wasn't it?
Yes, and he wanted to be the richest man in the world. Mm-hmm. It was about money, which gave him a feeling of security and influence and power. And then as he got older, he started losing people. His friends, some of them passed away. His family members, his father, his aunt, to whom he was very close, and then his wife, upon whom he was extremely dependent. And he started to realize that relationships mattered. He'd always focused on friendships, but he started to realize that other relationships mattered even more than he had thought. And my husband read the book, and the first time he read it, he came into the living room with tears in his eyes, and he said, I thought this was a book about money, and now I realize it's a book about love. And that really touched me because it's exactly right. Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is. And it's the thing that other thing that's so interesting is that, you know, he came about that at what, the age, and it's in his 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't something that he had had, you know, his whole life. It was, oh, wait a second. I've been on this course, but this is actually where I want to be. And having those relationships, and then interesting to see how his relationships with his children changed as his wife moved on.
Yes, and you know, I think he's worked at that, and it's, you know, it's important not to overstress. It's not nirvana. It's not perfect. If you've ignored your children during their whole childhood, there's certain repairs that you cannot make. And so I would not advocate ignoring your children and then thinking you can make it up later. But I do think it's a hopeful message that you are able at any age to turn around and make substantial progress on seeing the wisdom of what's really important in life and the meaning of life when you get a wake-up call. And it doesn't matter when it happens, and you can make changes. And that's the point at which he gave his money away to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and to create the largest philanthropic endeavor in history.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a very important thing.
Now, did he fail much? Because, and I know in high school, and I was just telling somebody this fact the other day, I said, you know, Warren Buffett actually didn't do too well in high school. And then I know he had actually signed up for that Dale Carnegie course, and then not gone the first time. And it wasn't until sometime later that he actually went and did the course. But were there other failures in his life of business?
Yes, in his life of business, he's actually had quite a number of failures. And in fact, one of the instructive parts of his tale is that you can achieve success even if you fail half the time or, you know, some large percentage of the time. And so what I'd like to kind of run through real quick is the kinds of failures that he had. He even made the same mistakes over and over again. And the mistakes were he was always trying to buy bargains because he's pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would see that something was cheap, and he would ignore looking at its quality. The other kinds of business mistake he would make is he would get infatuated with a person who was charismatic. He would trust that person without checking them out, and then he would end up finding that he had trusted too quickly, and then he would end up losing money. And his fail-safe, and the reason that it didn't matter in the end, and he got so rich, and this is an idea that anybody can apply, and I think it's so wise, is he has this concept called a margin of safety. And the margin of safety says that any time you make a decision anywhere in life, you should assume that you don't know everything possible about the decision, that you could be missing some assumption, you could be wrong. So build in some margin of safety in order to protect yourself against making a wrong bet. And an example of that would be if you're going to cross a bridge and the weight limit on the bridge is 10,000 pounds, don't drive a truck over the bridge that weighs 9,999 pounds. You know, the margin of safety, you probably drive an 8,000-pound truck over the bridge, but you wouldn't push it to the limit. In our financial life, we can adopt the margin of safety in terms of investing, you know, not the maximum that we have in any one thing, mm-hmm. not borrowing, you know, up to the limit. simple things, you know, not assuming that you'll have your job forever, but knowing that someday it might go away and living accordingly. And in relationships, in trust, Bernie Madoff is an example. You know who Bernie Madoff mm-hmm. was. A lot of people didn't allow a margin of safety. They didn't consider that maybe if anything went wrong, you know, putting all their money with Bernie Madoff could turn out to be a bad idea. So Warren always built in that margin of safety. And in the end, even when he made mistakes, it never hurt him that much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, he says, rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one. And that applies to almost everything, actually. It applies to, you know, relationships and just almost everything.
The rule number one and rule number two, or the margin of safety?
Well, both, because the way you don't lose is by having that margin of safety. Because you should assume that you're not going to make every decision correctly. And so the way that you hedge against that is by building little margins of safety and backup plans into the things that you do. So, you know, there's ideas that if you, for example, are going to quit your job and take another job and you know it's a risky job, then, you know, make sure that you have some other resources to draw on. Excuse me. Make sure that, you know, someone else in your family is working, or you have a little savings, or you have a fallback that you could go back to a different job. There's all kinds of ways of having that margin of safety, but it's basically don't bet the ranch. And if you just sit down and think, you know, don't bet the ranch, what could go wrong, and curb your enthusiasm a little bit, it can save you from making big mistakes.
This is Corinne Monikaitis, and my guest today is Alice Schroeder, who is the author of The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. And so, Alice, we were talking about the margin of safety and then the two rules that Warren has. And we were talking about mistakes that he's made. And would you say that buying Berkshire Hathaway was a mistake?
I would say it was a mistake. Berkshire Hathaway was a textile mill that made men's suit linings. And it was a business that had never prospered since the early part of the 20th century because who's going to pay extra for a men's suit lining? You can't charge a premium for it because it goes inside the suit. Nobody really sees it. And so they would go to Sears Roebuck and they would say, we need to raise prices a penny. And Sears would say, out the door with you. Forget it. So that when costs rose over time, they couldn't keep up with the pricing and raise prices to their customers. And when Warren saw this company, he saw that it was a cheap stock.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, oh, it's cheap. But he didn't really think about the business and whether the business itself could be successful. He just started buying the stock. And eventually he controlled the whole company for his partnership. And then he looked at it and said, oh, what the heck am I going to do with this? It's a bad company. And so he was stuck with the problem of Berkshire Hathaway. And over the next 30-some-odd years, he slowly closed down plants. Workers, one by one, retired and quit. They had a few little layoffs. They sold off equipment, and finally, in the mid-1980s, they shut the doors. And what he was left with was the corporate shell, basically the articles of incorporation of a company named Berkshire Hathaway that was just nothing but a piece of paper. And that piece of paper became the holding company for Berkshire Hathaway today, which is one of the Fortune 500 companies. I believe it's number 13 in the Fortune 500. But all it does is it owns other companies. So all the money that was ever spent for Berkshire Hathaway ended up being wasted and just drained away because it was a bad company and a bad buy.
Well, and, you know, I just think that prior to knowing about this, again, like I said, I knew about Warren Buffett and had read some investment books about him or just, you know, his thoughts about investing. But I didn't really think that much further into who he was as a person besides of like who he represented in the financial world. And reading this, it just gave me so much insight. And this is something that I talk with my clients about, too, was, you know, again, when he was 20 years old, he didn't set out to say, oh, I'm going to have this company named Berkshire Hathaway. Right. Because really what happened was that was a mistake. But then he didn't want to let it go. And then he eventually created this holding company from that. And it's something that evolved. And didn't it evolve also after he decided to, I don't know if retire is the appropriate word, but kind of dissolve his partnerships?
That's right. He had an investing partnership that he opened in 1956. It was extremely successful until around 1968, and then the stock market began to become in a bubble, like the bubble that we've had the last few years. And when he saw that, he decided, I've got to adapt to circumstances. I've got to do something different with my life, because if I just keep doing what I've been doing, things are not going to work out. And so he wrote his partners a letter and said, I'm going to close the partnership. I'm going to give you back your money, and I'm going to retire. And at the time, you know, it was 1968, so he was not even 40 years old. But he stopped working, and he spent a couple of years dabbling in politics. And then he had the shares of Berkshire Hathaway left over that the partnership had owned. But he's an ambitious person. So the bottom line is that he was flexible, he adapted to changing circumstances, and then he took what was left. He took the resources he had, he looked at them, and he said, what can I do with this? And he had this failing textile mill, and he said, I can buy other companies with it. I can buy stocks with it. And he decided that he would use that to create something else. And it was a good lesson for me, because what I saw is that we have this picture of entrepreneurs, that entrepreneurs have this grand plan on paper, mm-hmm. and that they know on day one that, you know, they're going to create, for example, Google is going to be what it is today. But that's actually not what happens. What they do is people who are really successful say, I have this resource and this resource and this resource, and I need to do something with it. What can I do? I've got this, and I'm going to make something out of it. And they just create a little plan and improvise, and then in baby steps, they just go forward. And that seems to be the route to success. At the risk of going on at too much length here, I've been studying a lot of entrepreneurs lately, and that seems to be a pattern with all of them, is they go baby steps, and they take what they've got, and they work with it instead of being grandiose and thinking huge.
And thank you for pointing that out for my listeners. Those baby steps are really important, instead of, you know, thinking, because otherwise it becomes overwhelming. It's like, well, how do you get to that? You know, I mean, originally when he was a 10-year-old boy, his idea was to get to $1 million at 35. And I mean, that's still pretty grandiose, but he's also a little kid, mm-hmm. and he just kept working towards that. And he also did not disbelieve that it was possible. He believed it was possible. So I think that helped him keep his momentum going, mm-hmm. as he went through. And then, you know, he originally retired at what, 26, with $156,000 or something?
Yes. But importantly, he did not have the attitude that, you know, if I'm not a millionaire at 35, then I will go and declare myself a failure. What he did is, year by year, he focused on that year's goals and that week's goals, one thing at a time. And he had in his mind, I believe that I could do this, but he wasn't actually day by day thinking, I must be a millionaire. He was thinking, you know, this week I've got to make these decisions, and I have to make these decisions right. And if I make these decisions right, then next week I'll be better off than I am this week. And that's how he sort of looked at it. And again, I've been spending a lot of time with people who are doing startup businesses, and I see this over and over. They're really, really pragmatic about not taking a ton of risk by making big commitments all at once, but rather baby steps. So if they're starting out with a new business, they'll test it in a little market. They'll go find somebody who will sell a little bit of it for them, and they won't put up a ton of money right away. They'll wait and see if they can get some sales, and they'll get some feedback and reaction. Then they'll change and do a little more and do a little more, and they don't take a lot of risk. They just build a little at a time and build a little at a time, and that's, I think, how great things happen.
So it's having the vision, and then it's being able to do the little baby steps as you're going forward. It's like, this is kind of the vision of where we want to go,
mm-hmm.
and then breaking it down into bite sizes that don't feel overwhelming.
Yes, and also being aware that over time that vision is going to change, mm-hmm. that it's just an idea. Because even Warren Buffett, when he started, thought of himself as someone who buys and sells stocks. Mm-hmm. But by the time he was 40, he was buying and selling whole companies.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he was 60, he had created a big corporation that employed more than 100,000 people, and it was a business like an IBM or General Electric. And that was never, when he first started out, it was never in his mind to do anything like that. But those baby steps over the years gradually evolved by making one logical decision after another, and as he adapted to what made sense. So I think you know, you have a direction in mind, but it's like a sailor who's constantly shifting a little bit with the wind to make sure that they stay on course, but they also, if they see an obstacle up ahead or if they see a better port up ahead, they go in that direction.
And when he would make mistakes, would he beat himself up about it?
Actually, no, and that's a great question, Corinne, because what he would do when he would make a mistake, it would just be like, whoosh, move on. he is someone who is self-critical, but he's self-critical in his dealings with people. And in business, you know, he just move on to the next. And his goal would be to find the next opportunity or recoup from that mistake as quickly as possible, because the only thing that would matter after a mistake is what can you do next to succeed better. You know, the mistake, he would consider it doubling the mistake to spend more time thinking about the mistake, because you're just putting time, and it's like you're investing in the mistake by doing that.
Ooh, I like that. You're investing in the mistake. Mm-hmm. I like that. You know, because when I've coached athletes, or now with my coaching clients that I do with entrepreneurs or life coaching clients, sometimes when they make those mistakes, they use it to define who they are. And he just didn't. Like, I mean, Berkshire Hathaway, again, I just laugh because I think how funny it is how he bought this company, and it was a rather big mistake, and he just held on to it and transformed it into something that could eventually work. But it took a really long time even to do that. Mm-hmm. But most people would have said, oh, I'm such a failure. I bought this thing, and, you know, what did I do? And they would beat themselves up and see, I'm a failed entrepreneur. And he just didn't do that. And I just found that so incredible, you know, and I call it clean thinking. He just had such clean thinking.
He treats mistakes as a form of research and development. So he believes in doing what he calls postmortems, where if you have made something, whether a good or bad decision, either way, you sit down, you take a few minutes, take on a piece of paper, and you say, this worked out, you know, spectacular, you know, scale of 1 to 10, it was a 0 to a 10. And then you say, why? Why did it? Why didn't it? And then you go, okay, the next time I'm going to keep doing this, and I'm not going to do that. And you take what you learn, and you consider it to be your laboratory. So it's a very productive way of looking at it. And I think it was it Thomas Edison? Somebody said, you know, how long did it take you to make the light bulb? And he said, I did it 99 times wrong before I got it right. And so, you know, I had 99 failures, and the reason I got it right is those 99 times I failed. You know, those failures are what made him able to succeed.
And that's incredible. And what did you call it? You called it investing in what?
Investing in failure, which is when you're spending time ruminating on it and beating yourself up over it and going over and over it, instead of using it as a way to make your next endeavor better, which is a postmortem. You know, people do a postmortem, after something is dead and buried, you know, or about before it's about to be buried, okay, before something has died, you do a postmortem to figure out, you know, what happened. And a postmortem is a quick, clean procedure where you say, if this thing died on the operating table, I'm going to figure out if it had appendicitis or what happened here. And then you move on, you have the little funeral, and then it's buried, or the person is buried. And that's what a postmortem is. And whereas investing in failure is where you're continuing to put energy into it.
Okay. And do you think, because some people may have these limiting beliefs, okay, well, that's Warren Buffett, I can't be like that. But what can we learn? And also, since you're working with entrepreneurs who are at a much different level in their business than where Warren Buffett is it possible to take these nuggets from Warren Buffett and apply them in our life and be successful, move us up our own personal ladders?
Well, here's what I would say. A, yes. And B, here's why. You know, we don't all have his gift for mathematics, for memory. He has a phenomenal memory. And we don't all want to be the world's richest man as badly as he did. So we're not all going to end up with $50 billion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's okay, because a lot of us don't also have his handicaps. And he started out with enormous, enormous handicaps. A, born in the Great Depression. B, severely abusive mother.
Mm-hmm.
Read the book. Was literally tortured mentally as a child, to the point that he said, by the time I was 3 years old, I was broken and it could not be put back together. Emotionally abused to the point that, I mean, if it were me, I could never, you know. So most of us are not, even though many people have had a lot of trauma, the degree of trauma he had was almost stunning. And still, he was able to do these things. So most people don't have the aspirations that are quite as lofty as him, but whatever their aspirations are, the tools that he used are accessible to absolutely anybody. And the fact that he was able to use them, having had the traumatic life experience that he has, tells me that anybody should be able to at least get some benefit from them.
And to help them move forward on their own, it's really our own journeys, right? Mm-hmm. And you're right. He has exceptional mathematical skills. I mean, he really likes statistics. And he did go through a bunch of trial and error because he did start out as a stockbroker and realized he didn't want to be on the different side of the table of his clients.
That's right.
And that's why I just feel like his book, even though he is so successful and he is, you know, so put up on that statute for most of us, we can learn so much from his own journey that we can take and actually very pragmatically apply in our own life. It's not just a pipe dream, I guess. And that must be what's resonated so big with your book with me, is that it's not just a pipe dream. It's that we can take look at the skills that he wasn't even born with all of the skills,
right,
but he was able to develop some of them. Some of them he was naturally good at, but he was able to develop others that were even in areas of his weakness.
That's right. He definitely was somebody who worked at it. I think the key is that he put in the time to practice. He's somebody who played basketball and he did weightlifting when he was young, and he learned the quality of repetition.
Mm-hmm.
So when he would get an idea and he would say, this will work for me, you know, practicing the discipline of not criticizing people, for example, then he would, every day, he would get up and he would say, I'm going to try that today and I'm going to do it again tomorrow and next week, instead of just going, oh, that's a great idea, and then forgetting about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the key to a lot of these techniques is whether you actually do them or not consistently. And even if you forget them for a week, coming back to them, which is what he did.
Well, and that goes with like Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours, right? You just keep doing stuff over and over and over, and you're eventually going to get better at that. And so now you have a person who's been doing it for, what, 60 years?
That's right.
You know?
That's right. But the good news is with a lot of these neuroprogramming techniques, the mental techniques, mm-hmm. they don't take anywhere close to 10,000 hours to change your way of thinking and reframe it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
thank you for saying that. Because the whole neuroprogramming thing is amazing. And when people start to really understand that it's not just some woo-woo stuff, it's real stuff that goes on in our brains.
Mm-hmm.
So
it really is. And to some extent, you can do some of these things very fast. I was at a program last week where they did the thing where you just put the rubber band around your wrist, and if you have negative thoughts, you just snap your wrist. And, you know, in a week, you can start retraining your brain with that. It's amazingly how quickly that works. There's all kinds of little techniques you can do that way, and you don't have to think, you know, decades for positive change in your life.
There we go. That could be exhausting for some.
Yes. Everybody. Well, that's the other thing. There's a whole variety of things that work.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very lucky to live in an era, and I think this is a really important thing to think about Warren Buffett. Why do these ideas work for you? He grew up at a time when psychology was absolutely embryonic. People hardly knew anything about how the human mind worked. They certainly didn't understand the mind-body connection, and it was shameful to say you needed help. And so he was completely self-taught and figured all this out on his own. Whereas today, we have this dazzling array of techniques and ideas, and, you know, they all work, or nearly all of them work, and you can find a lot of different paths making your life better, and you just need some help figuring out what you want and how to get there. So we are so lucky to live in an era where you can find these different techniques that you can use, because they really do work. And, you know, Warren Buffett made it work without even having that. So, you know, everybody should feel positive about that.
I'm wrapping up our discussion with Alice Schroeder, author of The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. And so, Alice, you gave so many takeaways today already throughout the show. I'd like to just kind of recircle back and repoint them out to our listeners about what you think are a couple that could be really helpful for them to help them move up the ladder of their own life.
First of all, I think that not being defined by your circumstances is probably the most important, because if I ever saw anybody who wasn't, it was Warren Buffett. You know, he took control and he took charge, and he learned to separate in his mind, this is number two, what was happening and how he felt from his actions. And so he would simply decide that he wanted to achieve a goal, and he would go find a tool. And then third, he would consistently practice and practice using that tool, and he let the tool shape his mind. And so instead of investing in failure by ruminating on his mistakes, he used his failures by doing little postmortems of them and turning them into laboratories. He let them become the R&D for his successes. So that would be kind of a summary, I would say.
And I can see this working well for entrepreneurs. And what about people that are working in the corporate world or for institutions right now and are feeling this squeeze of what's happening in the financial world? Can these still be applied to them in their current jobs?
Yeah, and actually, I think everybody today needs to think of themselves as an entrepreneur, because we've all got to take responsibility and take accountability for our own lives, and B, the business world is changing very fast, and corporations are not the havens today that they were in the past, and so we all know that at any time, we may want to start a business on the side. We may want to have a second career. A lot of people, work someplace 20 years and then they want to do a startup business, or they may do it, they may be forced to. So I think having an entrepreneurial mindset is something everyone should be cultivating, no matter where they work. And also, a lot of big companies are starting within the company entrepreneurial ventures, meaning places within the company where you can bring ideas and they will reward you for that. So this is something that I think everyone should be trying to cultivate within themselves, because in the new economy, it's a place that you can be rewarded and protect yourself. Again, that margin of safety.
I have a question to ask you, because I had Bob Sullivan on a couple weeks ago. He's a consumer advocate and another New York Times bestselling author. And he made a statement because we were talking about the recession and the unemployment, and he made a statement that 26 to 54-year-old men, white men, are underemployed right now. And do you feel that there is, because I look at it as the windows of possibility, right? But do you see that at a certain age or certain demographics that they are locked out, or that in this new economy that there are still possibilities?
I look at everything on an individual basis, Corinne, mm-hmm. because while you see these statistics, I don't think they're meaningful for individual people. So statistically, what's happened is this. A lot of manufacturing jobs have disappeared, jobs in the auto industry, for example, and that's disproportionately affected men. And if you've worked your whole life on an assembly line, for some of those people, retraining is going to be more difficult than others. But at the same time, I firmly believe that no individual is a prisoner of their circumstances, and that anyone who wants to and has the ability, they're not, prevented from it in some way, can absolutely succeed if they work at it hard enough. But the interesting thing is everybody won't. And this should be a great message of optimism. There's sayings, in these self-help seminars that, mm-hmm. There's all the people sitting in the room, and some percentage will go away and they'll use the information, and some percentage will just listen and not. Well, that's great, because it means that anyone who does, there's wide open opportunity for. And when we look back to the Great Depression, many of the companies that are the biggest and most important today were formed then. Much of what was the economy that was built over the next 50 years started during the Great Depression. Whenever there's a lot of change, there's always a ton of opportunity for people who seek it out. And it also doesn't mean that you have to work 10,000 times harder than everybody else. It just means that you have to be open to it and willing. So I believe everything is individual, everything is up to you, and you're not a prisoner of fate, nor a statistic.
Well said. And I appreciate you going into that, because well, California right now, we're bankrupt, right? We're not bankrupt, but California's not doing too well these days.
Yeah. Neither is Connecticut, where I live, so we're the third most bankrupt state. So,
And there's a lot of fear that's out there, and some people are starting to feel that doors are shut to them. Mm-hmm. And so what I hear you saying is, okay, maybe you have to go through some retraining and stuff, but looking for the areas that there are changes that are going through.
It is hard, and I don't want to downplay or minimize how hard it is, because a lot of people are really, really suffering, mm-hmm. and the economy is, it's certainly more pleasant when the economy is good. So I don't want to sound like I'm dismissive at all of what people are going through, and nor that I am dismissing what hard work it is. But my point is this, that anybody who's trying and, you know, gets 10 rejections or 50 rejections, doesn't mean that the 51st time will be a rejection or if they're creative. The fact that you're a male over 55 doesn't mean that you can't find something to do. In the end, you know, categories don't matter. There are people who are going to be very successful and there are people who aren't, and it isn't because you're a certain age or because you're a certain gender or anything like that. It's a tough economy, but there are some people who are going to make it. And, you know, all you can do is put yourself out there, do the best you can, you know, and put your best self out there and then hope that it's you because you had the right attitude.
And by putting your best self out there, you need to have clean thinking.
Of course.
Oh. Well, Alice, thank you so much for coming back on my show today.
Well, Corinne, thank you for having me. It was great fun.
It was great fun. This is Corinne Motokaitis, and we've had Alice Schroeder. She is the author of The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. And you've been listening to How She Really Does It on KDRT LP 95.7 FM.